Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, behind the lies of George Santos. The embattled congressman from New York remains in the House of Representatives, but it's not clear for how long. Misgivings about the representative's resume became a national story when the New York Times published a piece in December, but it was actually a small weekly paper in his district that first dug into his background. And what they found was fishy, to say the least.
He was a fraud. We called him a fabulist. We called him the talented Mr. Santos.
Brent Lally is the publisher of the North Shore Leader, and he joins me today. Also, Isaac Stanley Becker, national political reporter at the Washington Post. He's been digging into George Santos's finances and found falsehoods, Ponzi schemes, and ties to a Russian oligarch. We spoke Thursday morning. It's good to have you both with us. Grant Lally, if I could start with you, when and why did you begin looking at George Santos and his background?
Well, I first met George Santos 3 years ago when he approached us at the newspaper, at the North Shore Leader, and approached me to meet with him. I had run for Congress in this very same district 8 years ago, and obviously my family owns the newspaper, so he was looking for support. And a mutual friend had arranged a lunch where the three of us, he, I, and the mutual friend, sat down and had about an hour and a half lunch.
What did you think of him then?
I thought he was a real weirdo. He struck me as strange right from the start. I mean, he was...
Strange how?
You know, he would sit back and sort of wallow in the attention he was getting. He was bragging about his money. He was very young. He was only 31 at the time. And it seemed improbable that this young guy, so very, very wealthy, he seemed to be trying to make a point. And it really wasn't what a candidate for office normally would do. And I found it very off-putting at the time.
So did you then begin looking at his background?
Well, as time went on, and he ran in 2020, and he lost in 2020 by 15 points, as expected. Then he announced he wanted to run again in 2022, right after the election. By the way, he declared victory in 2020, even though he ended up losing by 15 points, because at one point in the middle of the count, he was a couple of thousand votes ahead of his opponent, but half the vote hadn't been counted yet. So very strange. He even, and this was bizarre, he flew down to Washington in around Thanksgiving time to participate in the freshman orientation for newly elected members of Congress.
This is in 2020 or 2022?
No, this was in 2020.
After he had lost, or...
The election wasn't certified because of all the paper ballots, wasn't certified for a month, and he was already a sure loser. But he declared victory. He flew down to do freshman orientation because that hadn't been certified yet, and he was so brazen about it, they let him participate at least for a few days. And then when the election was certified, he was told, look, you're not welcome. You're not part of this incoming class.
During the 2022 campaign, what was your newspaper publishing about George Santos?
Well, we published a series of stories in September and October of 2022. Where we screamed that he was a fraud. He was we called him a fabulist. We called him the talented Mr. Santos. And what we knew, and it was only a part of the story, but what we knew was that his financial disclosures didn't reflect what the campaign was on the ground. And perhaps I'm uniquely placed because I ran for Congress. I know what it's supposed to look like. And when I see a financial report that says $1.5 million is spent, but there's nothing, I mean, nothing, not a lawn sign, not a palm card, not a campaign office open, not a piece of direct mail, not a TV ad. I wonder where that $1.5 million has gone, or which we still suspect is a lot of it isn't real. These were just fake numbers put down. So we knew he was lying. He's such a bizarre guy. He would lie to people, and he would lie to one person and say one thing, to the next person and say a completely opposite thing. And we knew both people. So we got to compare the notes and see that what a blatant sociopath he really is.
So turning to you, Isaac, when 2022 came along and George Santos did win, when did the Washington Post, the New York Times, then begin looking at his background?
Well, I certainly have to tip my hat to Grant for having broken this story open, a long time before the national media, and think that it is a real shame that more in the national media did not follow Grant's reporting sooner. So
let me interrupt you right there.
Sure.
Let me ask you the question, why? Why not?
I think that's really worthy of some self-reflection. I could really only speculate, especially being based in DC and not being a avid follower of the ins and outs of New York politics. Specifically, my focus is national. I spent a lot of time toward the end of last year focusing on some of the chaos in Arizona, some of the candidates there. But I think it probably speaks to some of the disinvestment in local and, you know, metro reporting by national media outlets. And, there's of course also questions about why there wasn't better opposition research by Democratic groups. I don't know if there was an awareness that he had lied about various aspects of his biography and pedigree, and that was just kind of accepted. You know, we live in such an era of lies and misrepresentation and misinformation that I think there's almost an expectation that our politicians are lying to us, and perhaps that gives some just cover for even more brazen lies. But it really is remarkable that this, now looking back, this was out there because of Grant's work. And it wasn't until shortly before the new year, if I'm getting my timeline right, that the New York Times had this big story that alerted many of us to what had actually already been out there.
Grant, during the publication of that series of articles, did you reach out to any of the larger news organizations pointing out what you had discovered?
Well, we are in our subscriber base, we have a lot of the reporters and owners of the daily newspapers in our area. I mean, we're the North Shore of Long Island. We have multiple billionaires on our subscription list. We have the owners of a lot of these, and the principals and who are our subscribers. So it got out there, but also, and I'll, you know, to give, we endorsed Robert Zimmerman, who was the Democratic candidate. And again, we're mostly a Republican leaning newspaper, but we thought this wasn't a close call. And we endorsed Zimmerman. And I know Robert Zimmerman tried to get this story out. He sent, I think he told me he sent 85,000, you know, mass blasts on social media. He had people going over to Newsday, which is Long Island's daily paper, repeatedly. And, you know, that's really where it should have been picked up. The New York Times should have, Newsday should have, but it really wasn't until after the election. And let me give the New York Times credit. I mean, they did some fabulous journalism. They dug deep. They had people in Brazil. They had people who were able to penetrate the bureaucratic door of institutions like Goldman Sachs and Baruch College, and really get people to acknowledge whether Santos had any affiliation there or not, something that a political campaign wouldn't be able to do. But again, this should have been done before the election to spare us this, this national embarrassment that we have now.
Okay, so Isaac, tell me when you got onto the story.
So one of my primary focuses is campaign finance and money in politics. And when this became a national news story, that aspect of it was just such an important facet. All of this just seemed like a walking campaign finance violation. So that's immediately where I trained my focus. And there's many different aspects of this. Grant mentioned some of the funny business or seeming funny business about his reported spending and reported fundraising. That's one area. His filings with the Federal Election Commission are just filled with incomplete or obviously inaccurate information, repeated spending of $199.99 just below the threshold that would require receipts or other proof of payment, that amount on things like a hotel in South Beach in Miami or multiple dinners that just, you know, defies belief. It's just not possible. So there's already been complaints about that to the Federal Election Commission. But then there's also this whole mystery surrounding his personal finances and his business relationships. How does someone go from reporting a salary of $55,000 in 2020 when he first runs for Congress to multiple millions of dollars 2 years later through a kind of family company with no public-facing profile, no real record of business deals? So that's where my colleagues and I have been training a lot of our attention and understanding. So much about this person is fictional, we've learned, but what are the facts about his actual financial ties, financial backers, and his access to money, so much so that he was able to loan his campaign more than $700,000.
And what did you find out about that?
Well, we're still trying to understand more, but we've been able to piece some together. And one of the more interesting dynamics here is we were able to learn a fair bit more about one of his main benefactors. So there's this New York investor, Andrew Introtter, who was one of his main donors on the campaign. Both he and his girlfriend donated the maximum amount to Santos's campaign and also tens of thousands of dollars more to various committees linked to him. What we were able to find out is that the relationship actually goes deeper than that. We got access to some video footage from the congressman's time at a Florida investment firm, where he claimed that Mr. Introtter's company was actually a client of his. And then we also learned that one of Mr. Introtter's companies had put hundreds of thousands of dollars into that Florida investment firm where Mr. Santos had worked. Now, I should say an investment firm that was accused by the SEC of running a Ponzi scheme, essentially of bilking investors out of millions and millions of dollars. So we think this is interesting because Mr. Introtter is the cousin of a sanctioned Russian oligarch. And, you know, both men had been caught up in the Mueller probe and the investigation by the special counsel into possible ties between then President Trump and the Kremlin. And Mr. Introtter had cultivated Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer and self-described fixer. And so what was this relationship between Mr. Introtter and Mr. Santos? Why did he become such a large donor to the campaign? What did he want from him? And why was he also putting money into this investment firm, which was promising like 18% returns, which to any savvy investor, as Mr. Introtter is should just be a giant red flag.
So how much further have you been able to go in understanding exactly what that relationship was?
We've sought an interview with Mr. Introtter. We've put detailed questions both to him and to some of his lawyers and have not heard back. I think it would be something that I think they should want to clarify. Certainly if someone said that I was their client and I wasn't their client, I would want to clarify that and get the facts out. We're definitely trying to learn more. We're also trying to learn more about other people who may or may not have been his clients. I mean, back to something I said before, there's so many lies that this person has told. And so he said, this person is my client, that person is my client. And so it just requires a level of verification and corroboration that goes beyond, you know, the ordinary taking at face value, him describing his own business relationships.
And Grant Lally, going even farther back, what did your newspaper find out about his education?
Well, you know, we took his claim that he attended Baruch College at face value. You know, we didn't really have access to it until the New York Times broke that part of the story, that he was a high school dropout, never attended college, never attended NYU for an MBA. All of that was fake. But, you know, look, he talked the talk. And I was with him. He wouldn't talk to me. Once we endorsed against him in 2020, if I walked into a room, he would walk to the opposite side of it. I mean, it was actually strange because no politician does that. No normal politician. You'll always go up and talk to someone, especially someone whose family owns a newspaper. You'll want to, you know, curry favor. He did the opposite. It was like kryptonite. I'd walk in, he'd run to the other side of the room. But I think it's because we had already written a few articles that had exposed him. Maybe he sensed that we sensed what a fraud he was. And a lot of my friends tried to befriend him, helped him, campaigned with him, went shopping with him. But it's really classic sociopathic behavior. Even when it really wasn't to his direct advantage, he would take people on these sort of manipulative journeys. He grabbed one local contractor who had run for office, a former candidate, and took him on an odyssey of the North Shore of Long Island, pointing out one mansion after another and saying, oh, I own that one. I own that mansion. And the fellow was a contractor. So Santos said, well, I want you to do work. I want you to fix the kitchen. I want you to redo the bathrooms. But couldn't go in. Every time it was an excuse, they're cleaning asbestos out. There's a tenant in there. So they literally drove into the driveway of one mansion after another. And Santos pointed to the mansion and said, that's mine. And when the contractor said, oh, can I go in and have a look? He'd say, no, you can pull the plans from the local government. But it was all to no purpose. I mean, the contractor wasn't writing him a check. It was just a 4 or 5 hour odyssey. And I just think it was something psychologically that Santos needed, was to be able to manipulate people. And the fun part is he had the contractor send him pictures of work that the contractor was doing on other houses, texted them. And then Santos took those pictures later and showed them to other people and said, oh, this is work being done on my kitchen. This is the new bathroom I'm having installed. And of course, I knew both of the people. And so we ended up comparing notes. And the contractor looked at him and said, no, that's not Santos's kitchen. That's the kitchen I'm working on in a house in Oyster Bay.
Oh, wow. I mean, oh, wow. Now, Isaac, tell me about his claims with Citigroup and Goldman Sachs.
Well, he claimed to have worked at these entities and to have rubbed shoulders with all these elite bankers and financiers. And as Grant has said, these entities have just denied this. Now, one of the things, and also to Grant's point about what the lies he told various people, one organization where we think he did work was this group called Linkbridge Investors, which puts on conferences for various people, essentially tries to link up people looking for capital or people who have capital. And these conferences are sometimes attended by people from Goldman Sachs or people from Citigroup. And I was speaking to someone who had been on one of his campaigns who said, well, what he told me actually was that he worked for Linkbridge, which did work for Goldman Sachs or which performed some service for Goldman Sachs. So you can see how there is some kind of thread of veracity that gets you then to, if you're amping yourself up to working directly for Goldman Sachs. One thing I would also echo from Grant, and I haven't interacted with him directly. He hasn't responded to my questions. But I've reviewed all of this video from the time when he was working as an investor and running for office. And I agree that the lies are not especially slick and not especially effective. Now, I say this with the benefit of hindsight, now knowing about all the lies he's told, but there is something very awkward about his presentation. There is something that just comes off as quite obviously deceptive and not especially slick. So I find it surprising that he was really able to pull the wool over the eyes of so many people, including wealthy, savvy people who donated to his campaign. I just find it very surprising. And I think it speaks to the level of kind of deceit and the lack of authenticity and honesty in our political culture.
Generally speaking,
yes.
And he becomes the personification of something that is going not only through the Congress, but through the society at large, sad to say. So you reference Harbor City Capital, and that company is the one that's no longer in operation. Isaac, that's the one that was termed a Ponzi scheme. But then who is behind the DeVolder organization? That one's even more mysterious.
Well, this is really a black hole and an enduring mystery, and to my mind, a really important question about his financial position and about the honesty or lack thereof in his personal financial disclosures or candidate financial disclosures. And I should say, these disclosures are not an act of goodwill that candidates perform for the public. They are required by federal law. And intentional failure to disclose can bring really severe penalties, severe fines, and even up to 5 years in prison. So this is serious business, these financial disclosures. And that is where he reported all this income coming from in 2022, up to $5 million each year from this DeVolder organization. DeVolder is his maternal family name. So this, as I said, remains kind of a black hole. We've done a lot of reporting on Harbor City Capital, where we know he worked from late 2019 or early 2020 through at least April 2021. We know he was being paid by that group as recently as April 2021. It is sued by the SEC. It's shuttered. And within weeks, he's incorporated this DeVolder organization with the help of former Harbor City employees. So the timing is obviously very connected. There's personnel overlap. And he has not really explained what exactly DeVolder organization is or does, or he's offered different explanations for it. He said it's a family company, it does deals for people. He, in interviews before this scandal was kind of broken open, actually linked it more directly to Harbor City by saying that he set it up as kind of a life raft for former colleagues of his at Harbor City. So the connection is, there is some sort of connection, and we're still working to understand where DeVolder's money came from, how directly it was linked to Harbor City, and who its clients actually were, if any.
Grant, do you want to add to that?
He didn't set DeVolder up until 2021, and after he had lost the 2020 race. It started up, and he had nothing at that point. He declared he had no assets and virtually no income the year before. He sets up this shell company. He made claims on his financial disclosures that he was paid millions of dollars through this company, but then the company was dissolved just a couple of months ago. So the company didn't even exist for 2 years. And initially, and this I thought was very interesting, when he was challenged about it, he changed his story publicly. He's no longer said he made millions from DeVolder. He said he made millions brokering airplane and yacht sales. And he said, with my Rolodex, all I have to do is make a few calls. I can sell a $20 million yacht and I make a 10% commission. No big deal. It was very telling that he made that public statement. And now, of course, he says nothing. And he has now refounded the DeVolder organization, which was a dissolved business, if it was anything other than a piece of paper. And I doubt it.
But where did the $700,000 that he put into his own campaign, where did that come from?
Look, our suspicion when that happened, and that was early 2022, our suspicion is it was fake. He just pretended he got $700,000. He wrote the number in his disclosure without any money actually being there. And then a lot of the disbursements from his campaign were fake disbursements. And I think that's what we're going to find in the end is he declared he wrote a $100,000 check. It'll be a $10,000 check. He declares he wrote $10,000 for a beach resort. It'll be $1,000. I got a phone call from my old campaign manager who called me, just happened to be leafing through Santos's campaign filings in this past summer. And he said, Grant, I mean, what the F is this? This is not a campaign disclosure. First of all, it's thousands of pages. It has all these like Uber, $2.95. It's junked up in order to make it very hard to read. But he said, Grant, this is not a campaign. This is a beach party. And I don't know, and this is somebody in Washington, D.C., I don't know who these people are. I've never heard of these consulting groups that he's writing $10,000, $20,000, $40,000
to. So, Isaac, how did you follow up on all of those disbursements?
Well, I think that's a fascinating point, and I won't speculate, though I imagine that prosecutors are keenly interested in this question and will hopefully be able to provide more than speculation. But I will say that it would certainly mirror the types of statements that he has made and behavior he has engaged in previously. So this notion that he said he loaned $700,000 to his campaign, but in fact did not, would mirror, we think, the way he operated with Harbor City, where in the video footage I obtained, he talks about how he and his sister allegedly put in all this money in the investment firm in order to show investors that he had confidence in the company, to say, look, my own family put in all this money into these options. You should trust it too. And I'm not saying this is what happened, but you could see how his own loan or his own contribution to his campaign could be bandied about to other donors to say, I'm putting skin in the game. You should donate to my campaign as well. That's how he wanted to present himself.
Isaac, is it getting harder and harder to follow money that campaigns claim they have or where that money comes from, generally speaking?
It is certainly, because of the proliferation of especially these dark money groups, nonprofits, C3s, C4s, that don't have to disclose their donors. And there are elaborate ways in which the C4s will do independent expenditures, or the C4s will contribute a certain amount to the hard money groups. But this is kind of a whole new terrain. I mean, we're not used to, though maybe we should become more used to, questioning whether the actual reported contribution or expenditure is true or fake.
Now a quick break. Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianewayne.org/book club. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Grant Lally, publisher of the North Shore Leader, and Isaac Stanley Becker, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. This experience, Grant, I would think, for not only the national press, but the local press, sets the stage for more careful examination of a candidate's claims and background. I mean, right from the start, you had this nailed.
Well, look.
And people didn't pay attention.
Look, Santos it glows in the dark. And if you spend time around him, you can smell the fraud on him. And we weren't the only ones who smelled it. And part of the reason we were able to report what we did is because I'd have a state senator come up to me and say, this guy's a pathological liar. I would have people who worked on my campaign, really, you know, operatives who would take their Saturday afternoons or Friday nights and paw through his campaign filings and literally call me up and laughing and say, you wouldn't believe the nonsense he put down on page 750. Let me read you this. Let me read you that. And we literally have conversations for 45 minutes laughing over imagining him sitting around having a glass of wine, just making this stuff up. But if he were more plausible, I don't know that anyone would have even looked or paid attention. This was somebody who glowed in the dark.
So have any laws been broken, Isaac, that you're aware of?
Well, I think I really would leave that question to prosecutors. And we know that prosecutors in New York and in Rio de Janeiro, though on a slightly different matter, are looking into this, are looking into him and his campaign. There are allegations that he has broken federal campaign finance law, multiple complaints before the FEC about various matters, including this issue of the DeVolder organization that you rightly spotlighted, and about this contribution that he purportedly made to his own campaign. The allegation is that this wasn't his own money, but was in fact masking several or perhaps many other donors, which is not illegal. You candidate can loan as much as they want to their campaign, but you cannot say you are loaning money to your campaign when in fact that's coming from other donors. And then I also mentioned these candidate disclosures, which are required under federal law and have to be thorough and complete and honest. And I think it's a high bar, or what experts have told me rather, is that it's a high bar to prove intentional failure to disclose, which can bring the most severe penalties. But who knows what the paper trail looks like in terms of what he was and wasn't putting on these disclosures and what he was saying about his desire to either keep certain things off of them or to artificially insert earnings that weren't authentic.
Can you elaborate, either of you, on the Brazil connection? I don't know enough about that. Grant?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken extensively to reporters from the major newspapers in Brazil who contacted me pretty much when the story broke. I have his, somewhere around here, I have his criminal complaint file, which is 175 pages, extremely thorough criminal file from Brazil. That's obviously a continuing issue. That those charges were filed, and then he skipped the country and came to America. But
what kinds of charges?
Well, he stole a checkbook, and he admitted to this. So this is not alleged. He stole a checkbook from an 82-year-old home health care patient of his mother's. His mother was a home health care aide in Rio de Janeiro, one of the suburbs of Rio de Janeiro. He stole the checkbook. And he wrote forged a number of checks to buy himself things. And, you know, that's a crime. I'm told under Brazilian law, he could face several years in jail for elder fraud and for check forgery. But what's interesting is when he came to the U.S. and as his story has gained media attention and he's become a notorious figure, even though he uses multiple names, a whole series of crime victims have come forward to the media and presumably to local prosecutors, a woman who traveled here to the U.S. with him from Brazil. She alleges he stole thousands of dollars out of her bank account. She also alleges that he stole her jewelry and pawned her jewelry and kept the money. Just 2 days ago, a disabled American veteran came forward. Just a few years ago, the veteran had a service dog. The service dog needed an operation, and the veterinary clinic had referred him to a charity, which turns out to be a fake charity run by Santos. Santos ran a GoFundMe campaign, raised over $3,000, stole the money, closed down the GoFundMe, went dark, and the dog never got his surgery. The dog died. And I spoke to the disabled American veteran yesterday, and he is just furious. But that didn't come out early because he knew George Santos as Anthony DeVolder, which was another alias that Santos was using. But here you have a very recent case of Santos committing charities fraud, committing larceny. I mean, right here in the U.S. He stole a Burberry scarf, according to a former roommate, a $600 scarf, which he wore, ironically, to the January 5th Stop the Steal rally. So, I mean, this guy is a career criminal, and I'm sure this isn't all of it. So there will be more of these sort of street crimes coming out, and those are very easy to prosecute. And there are prosecutors chomping at the bit in this country to be the first one to file criminal charges against George Santos. And look, my fear, and we wrote this in our pieces, is he's a Brazilian dual national. The Brazilian constitution prohibits extradition of Brazilian nationals out of Brazil. And if he smells that the handcuffs are getting close, he'll board an airplane, he'll fly down to Rio, and we will never, I don't care how many charges are to be filed here, we will never get him.
But he can't be in Congress and be in Brazil at the same time, Isaac. What does he do about that?
That's very interesting. And I've actually spoken to some people who are still in touch with him who very much say the opposite, that he thinks he can ride this out, and who think that he's not going to resign or step down until he gets a, you know, prison sentence, who think he's just committed to putting his head down and ignoring this. Grant mentioned this just remarkable string of revelations about what he called, you know, street crimes in these instances, which are just stunning. There's also, and we know this has become a kind of lightning rod issue in U.S. politics about drag queens and different kinds of gender presentation. There's images that have emerged and accounts that have emerged from former friends and roommates of his about him being a drag performer, about him dressing up in drag in Brazil and performing. And he has issued a tweet this morning in which he says the media is focused on this and it's a complete lie. And we can all see these images which show him clearly in drag. And so he's asking us, you know, not to believe our lying eyes. So it's a remarkable instance of just pushing through and trying to ignore what is just a deepening scandal on so many different fronts.
Well, and a scandal for apparently Republicans who knew about this even before the 2022 election, Grant.
Look, nobody knew what we know now. I knew he was a fraud in a campaign sense and in a personal sense, and I knew there was something profoundly wrong with him. But if you weren't in this district and you just looked at it from outside, or even more so, if you were just looking at the paper filings, I mean, again, if you looked at the paper filings just 5 months ago, you think, wow, he's raised nearly $2 million at that point, and he spent nearly $2 million. This must be a really impressive campaign, but there wasn't a single TV ad. There wasn't a single lawn sign. There wasn't a single, no campaign headquarters, nothing. If you walk through the district in August of 2020, you'd have no idea that there was a human being named George Santos or whatever his alias might be. So the disconnect that we saw, because we were here, was tremendous.
But Isaac, what about Republicans currently in Congress? It has been said that many of them knew that George Santos was a fake.
There was reporting that one of Speaker McCarthy's top fundraising lieutenants knew some of the details, and the Speaker himself, I believe, over the weekend acknowledged in an interview that I think the language he used was that he had some questions about him, which seems to suggest some level of knowledge, though he hasn't said outright. I've been really interested in the divide that's opened up between Republicans in New York who have called for his resignation and Republicans in D.C., or at least Republican leadership in D.C., that has it seems, sort of grudgingly stood by him, or at least not joined those calls. And that reflects a kind of blunt political calculus about their majority and the very thin majority that they have. They don't want to lose that seat, even as Republicans in New York, you know, in the county and more broadly in the state, are basically screaming that this is a huge black eye for them.
So what about the people in New York, Grant, and the voters who voted for him?
Well, you know, as this campaign went on, and one thing I don't know if we've talked about here, but he was not supposed to be a serious candidate in a serious race until the congressional districts were redrawn by the top court in New York in June of 2022, 6 months ago. And the court stepped in, ripped up the map that had been passed in February, which made this district a non-competitive Democratic district. He was going to be a sacrificial lamb. It's very hard to get people to run for races where they know that they're going to lose the election, or everyone who's a political expert knows that. So, but in June, he suddenly found himself, I call it a reverse bait and switch. He was a sacrificial lamb. And the top court in New York gave him a very nice, marginally Republican district in what turned out to be a red wave year on Long Island. But let me tell you, among the worst, and this is why so many local Republicans are so furious with him, is that, you know, he conned them, and people hate being conned, first of all. I mean, it's brutal, you know, to know that some con artist fooled you. But worse, you know, he changed his identity. He pretended he was Jewish. He claimed his grandparents were Holocaust survivors from the Soviet Union, from Kiev. And he went to synagogues with local Jewish officials, Jewish Republican officials. I mean, one woman who was in the Israeli Defense Forces is a local legislator. He would go to synagogues with these people with tears rolling down his cheeks, talking about his family who survived, who were able to escape and survive the Holocaust. And, you know, inside these synagogues in the audience were people whose families were murdered in the Holocaust, who were gassed in the Holocaust. And this piece of garbage is up there pretending that, you know, he's part of that experience, lying to them, and worse, then asking them for money and asking them for votes and asking them, please come out and do a television commercial, or please come and tell your friends. So, I mean, it's so awful on every level. And everyone here feels it. I mean, it's a total disgrace, and it's a total outrage, and people want him gone and arrested and jailed.
What would it take for him to be gone?
Simple. 2/3 vote of the House of Representatives. And look, I know a lot of these members. I can tell you, I know all the ones in the area from New York. They're ready to cast that vote to expel him.
What do you think the moral lesson is here for journalism, Isaac?
Well, for journalism, I think it is to follow what Grant did, which is to meet and engage with these candidates and to look into their background and into their statements and not take them at face value, to thoroughly vet and seek public documentation, records, and speak to friends, associates, roommates, business partners, and to seriously investigate people who want to represent us in public office.
And, of course, with local journalism being on the wane, I mean, how many national reporters are going to look carefully at a district? Grant, what do you think the answer is?
Look, the answer is, you know, is an engaged civic culture. I mean, that's you know, we've been moving away from that with video and social media and the eternally flickering screen in front of our eyes that has us mesmerized. I think people need to be engaged. They need to talk to people. Look, I sat down with this guy for an hour and a half, and I looked at him, and I asked him a lot of questions, and I'm not shy to ask questions. I mean, I asked him all about his family background in Brazil, and I have friends in Brazil. I mean, first thing I asked him was, you know, I had assumed a finance executive from Brazil, highly successful. I assumed he was of Lebanese or Syrian heritage, because the business class of Brazil is heavily of Syrian and Lebanese descent. So I asked him that. And first of all, he had no idea what I was talking about, which I found stunning. Anyone who was in business would at least know that. I mean, the brand new vice president of Brazil is of Lebanese Syrian descent, Lula's running mate. I mean, it's part of the national experience in Brazil. He had no idea what I was talking about. And then I grilled him about his heritage. And, you know, he told me he was Portuguese, but he did have this Belgian ancestor from 150 years ago. Ironically, that was the truth. It may be one of the only times he's told the truth, but I don't know that he was ready to lie about that yet. So when he declared himself Jewish in 2022, I knew it was fake. I knew that was a lie. And so you have to look at people in the eye. I have to figure out who they are. And bottom line, character matters. Who is this person? Why are they doing this race? What are they about? That, you know, and they're not hard questions, but they're deep questions.
And final question for you, Isaac. What do you think the outcome of this story is going to be?
There's a political outcome. There's a law enforcement outcome. There's a journalistic outcome that Grant has helpfully outlined. As I've said, multiple jurisdictions, prosecutors are looking into this. And as Grant has mentioned also, you know, there's many jurisdictions that want to be first to bring charges. We'll see what happens and whether that also forces more acknowledgement of some of these issues from him, some answers. I think it's possible that a fair amount of this will play out in court politically if he does indeed refuse to resign and there isn't the 2/3 vote to remove him. It's hard to imagine him gaining re-election in 2 years, but we'll see. We live in remarkably surprising and unexpected political times. So who knows? Who knows where we'll be in 2 years?
I see this ending with him sitting on a hotel balcony in Rio with his feet up and a Mai Tai in his hand or some tropical drink, giving interviews, claiming he's a political refugee. That's how I see this one ending.
Wow. You know? Well, Isaac Stanley Becker, Grant Lawley, thank you both so very much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Grant Lawley, publisher of the North Shore Leader, and Isaac Stanley Becker, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'll see you next week. I'm Diane Reed.